Which secret garden will you tend today? My question is, how do you tend your secret garden? Do you even have one? One of the ways in which I tend mine is to remember and to honor those who have gone before me and shaped my life by how they lived theirs. I often find myself paying special attention to this in November because November's, well, it's an appropriate time to do this because of the month's bookends, All Souls Day at the beginning of the month and then Thanksgiving at the end. I come from a long line of dead people. Says a line from a Libby Roderick song. We all do. We come from long lines of dead people. Most of the people who are in my secret garden are dead, but not all of them. Another way to refer to this long line of dead people is to call them our honeys. The computer does not like that word. A phrase used by one of my favorite professors at Star King School for the Ministry, Claire Fisher. And what she meant by identifying our honeys was people whose writings, actions, lives influenced us. The first example that comes to my mind when I think of that professor is one of her honeys was Robert Bella. Anybody know that name? He was quite a well-known sociologist, and he died not terribly long ago, probably the end of the 1990s. You can look him up, B-E-L-L-A-H. You'll recognize a couple of the titles of his books. And yet another way is to refer to those who came before us as that great cloud of witnesses. I like that image. All those souls who have come before us, forming this cloud, and not that computer one, forming this cloud, looking down on earth, witnessing to both their own lives and to how we live our lives. Now, I don't mean this literally. Surely you know me well enough by now to know that. But it's a working metaphor for me. As I have said before, it can get really crowded up here with all of these souls, or at least the spirits, of so many people who have preceded me down through the ages. Here they are, all around us, as in a cloud, reminding us of their own lives and asking us to bear witness to those lives. Many of my honeys, the people in my cloud of witnesses, in the secret garden I cultivate to help me keep on keeping on, to remind me that I want to live daily in the garden of abundance, a garden of gratitude for the abundance of examples of lives well lived. Many of these people were prophets. I don't mean what maybe popped into your mind, the stereotype of a person who predicts the future. I don't mean that. The best sense of the word prophet means someone who tries to foretell the future by pointing out, warning us about our destructive behavior. It's not the same thing as predicting. Think Rachel Carson. And in this sense, Galen Smith was also a prophet, because he kept reminding us that we need to take better care of the environment. I think individuals have prophets within themselves, you know, like your inner Buddha, you have an inner prophet there too. That angel on one shoulder and the devil on the other image comes to mind. And maybe a guilty conscience is really our inner prophet trying to get through to us. In any case, it is entirely up to us, the living, to continue the work of those who have come before us. Or, I think you could make an argument that in some cases it's up to us to refute it, I suppose, if we're talking about questionable souls And I'm thinking about Hitler, Stalin, Pol Pot, Genghis Khan, you know, the bad guys and women in history. It is our duty, I think, to try to carry on that search for truth and meaning, the ongoing struggle to love one another, no matter our family structure, no matter any of those things that we mentioned at the beginning of our services, to always be aware of others who have been engaged in that same struggle and have passed the torch on to us. As I said to the children at the beginning of the story, for all ages, what we as free thinkers and religious liberals are working towards, I hope, is an ever-broadening and ever-expanding definition of family, not just individual families, but the human family, which involves constantly being skeptical about narrow definitions of what it means to be human and constant vigilance to prevent less than human ways of thinking. And I'm thinking particularly of last Sunday's service in remembrance of transgender folks and honoring them, and those two brave people who got up and told us their stories. I am inspired, I'm moved, energized by the many people from many different periods of history. So I'm going to tell you briefly about a few of them. Most are Unitarians, though you probably have not heard of these particular Unitarians. In preparing a Sunday service a few weeks ago, it was one of those focusing on humanism, I came across a story that I didn't use then, but it was a story about Unitarian minister John Haynes Holmes. Ever heard of him? Not to be confused with Oliver Wendell Holmes. John Haynes Holmes, born in 1879, died in 1964. Now, this is a thread, and I'm going to tie it together. But note his age. He lived a long life for that time period. He died at age 85. John Haynes Holmes was minister of what we now call Community Church in New York City, which is one of the largest in our association. But when Holmes began his ministry there in 1907, it was called the Church of the Messiah. And yes, it was a Unitarian church. He was there as the minister for 42 years. But here's the story that intrigued me. He refused to support World War I. And in so doing, he had a confrontation with William Howard Taft. You might recognize that name. Taft was, at the time of this confrontation, the moderator of the Unitarian Conference, what we now call General Assembly. Former President Taft, did you know he was a Unitarian?
Yes.
There are five Unitarian presidents. Can you name them?
Both Adamses.
Both Adamses. We claim Jefferson.
Yeah, we claim Jefferson.
And Taft, and one we never talk about.
Miller
Fillmore. Yes, Miller Fillmore. Well, we'll have to do the bathtub story sometime. But. Anyway, so Taft sponsored a resolution at this General Assembly asking the delegates for support of World War I. This resolution passed 236-9. The AUA, the American Unitarian Association Board, then resolved to withhold financial aid to, quote, any church whose minister was not in support of the war effort. Well, Holmes said, and left, taking his congregation with him. In essence, the whole congregation was excommunicated, or as close to that as we ever get. So, one has to wonder why he did that, or I think, well, obviously he was a pacifist, but maybe the better, more appropriate question is, why would our denomination support World War I? Holmes, or Unitarian Universalist minister David Bumbaugh says, if nothing else, this incident served as a reminder of how much a part of the national establishment Unitarianism was and how vulnerable it was to conventional thinking, even at the expense of its ancient principles. That's a pretty sweeping statement. and Bombaugh just wrote this recently in a new UU history book. I wonder if this statement's still true. Are we still a lot a part of the national establishment? Are we vulnerable to conventional thinking? How vulnerable are we, if so? The American Unitarian Association did eventually apologize to Holmes and to the Church of the Messiah, which in the meantime, during the war, had changed its name to Community Church, and they rejoined the American Unitarian Association. John Haynes Holmes was an amazing man. He endorsed socialism. He preached in favor of it often. He supported Margaret Sanger's crusade for women's reproductive rights. He backed Planned Parenthood when it was just a fledgling institution. He was also one of the first Americans to know who Gandhi was, and he became an avid supporter of Gandhi and the use of nonviolence to achieve social justice. These ideas that John Haynes Holmes embraced and preached about and put into practice in his personal life, pacifism, nonviolence, women's rights, socialism, are very important to me, and that's why he's definitely in my cloud of witnesses. But there's something else that was just as important in Holmes's belief system. It was the purpose of religion. He was very interested in what the purpose of religion was and what religion really means. I think that we cannot, this is inseparable from the quest to understand what it means to be fully human. And just a gentle reminder, I am usually defining religion as that which ultimately concerns us. Holmes believed that the basis of religion should not be concern about God, but rather concern about humanity, and that the center of religious life is not the individual, but the social group, the community, and not just any old community or social gathering of people, the community that works together for social change. That was radical thinking at the beginning of the 20th century, even for Unitarians. And I would argue that it is still radical thinking, even for Unitarians. But it wasn't just Holmes who was thinking this way. It's never just one person who starts or sustains a movement. There was Mary White Ovington. Ever hear of her? I didn't think so. She was born in 1865 and lived till 1951, so she was 86. She's definitely in my cloud. She was a member of the Community Church in New York when Holmes was the minister. Ovington worked initially as a director of a settlement house. You all know what those are. Think Dorothea Dix. The settlement houses had an incredibly huge influence on free thinkers then, progressive thinkers. So Ovington worked in Brooklyn in the late 1800s, and she somehow stumbled onto W.E.B. Du Bois's writings. At that point, Ovington kind of looked around the settlement house and realized that many people of color were not allowed into the settlement houses because of the color of their skin. She actually met Du Bois in 1905 at a conference in Atlanta, which led her to do research on the social conditions of black people in New York City. I mean, she's way ahead of her time. And this is what she concluded. This is her quote, that white racism lay at the very root of the Negro problem. This was in the early 1900s. Ovington met many black leaders, male leaders, in her deliberate travels to the Deep South. Now, think about that. It's the early 1900s. She's a single white woman. This was dangerous work. She got fed up with the lynchings and the race riots, even in places like Springfield, Illinois. So she put together a committee of black and white leaders, women and men, to sponsor a conference in 1909 at Cooper Union in New York, which became the NAACP. She was its first acting executive, and obviously one of the founders, the NAACP. A contemporary of Ovington's, Emily Green Balsh, who lived from 1867 to 1961, I really enjoy doing the math, with these birth and death dates. It's fascinating to me that so many of these progressive free thinkers lived long lives. I think this must be good for our health. Remember that when you get weary when you're working on social justice things. Emily Greenbalsh grew up in the First Church Unitarian of Jamaica Plain, Massachusetts, a suburb of Boston. She founded Boston's first settlement house, bringing social and educational services into a poor immigrant neighborhood. In 1905, she took a sabbatical from her teaching job at Wellesley College to study Slavic immigrant communities in America and the socioeconomic conditions in the Austro-Hungarian Empire. Now, why in the world would she do that? Well, because of the record number of immigrants coming to this country, especially from that part of the world. So it's not as if the immigrant problem, and I use problem in quotes, is new. In 1907, over 1.25 immigrants arrived in this country. And just like John Haynes Holmes, Emily Balsh was a pacifist, a socialist, and an internationalist, a combination I greatly admire and would be happy to claim to describe myself. And you see why these people are in my cloud of witnesses and give me a reason to get out of bed in the morning. Wellesley fired Balsh when World War I broke out, probably because of her anti-war views. This led, among other things, to Balsh and Jane Addams, a name you might know, founding the Women's International League for Peace and Freedom, which I hope still exists. I was afraid to look it up because I was afraid it doesn't. Okay, it needs some younger people, you younger people out there. Okay. Balsh and Addams were vocal critics of the Versailles Treaty, the one that ended World War I, and their criticism was right on. Their main concern about that treaty, that it would only lead to another major war. Someone should have listened. Emily Balsh was awarded the Nobel Peace Prize in 1946. Like Holmes, she temporarily left Unitarianism because of the war issue. She became a Quaker for a while, but she did come back to us. One more contemporary from that period, Roger Baldwin. Know that name? Do you know that name? All right. I'll give you a little star. 1884 to 1981. Another, as I said, contemporary. He grew up in the Unitarian Society of Wellesley Hills, Massachusetts, knowing from about the age of 10 that he wanted to be a social worker. His parents described themselves as agnostic Unitarians, which is the same way, interestingly, that John Haynes Holmes' parents described themselves. Baldwin says, in his own words, that he attended church regularly, he taught Sunday school, and I even listened to the preacher, he wrote. He was a social worker for a while in St. Louis, where he also taught at Washington University. Went back to the East and met Mary Ovington and Emily Balsh in 1917. He was jailed because of his leadership in something called the American Union Against Militarism and for his pacifism. Roger Baldwin founded the American Civil Liberties Union in 1920. So many others that I don't have time to talk about today. Sophia Lyon Foss, for example, you'll know that name, I hope. At the age of 61, she became director of curriculum development for the American Unitarian Association. Her birth and death dates, 1876 to 1978, 102. William Ellery Channing had said in 1837 that the great end in religious instruction is not to stamp our minds upon the young, but to stir up their own. Sophia Lyon Foss put this into practice, made it happen through her curriculum development. Do you see the thread? Do you see this thread here? The desire, the impulse, the passion to do good, not because these folks were do-gooders, quote, quote, but because they believed that the struggle to recognize all beings as equal in love, they believed that this struggle was the right thing to do. There's no question that they would live their lives accordingly. If I wanted to include a still very much alive honey of mine, it would be Rebecca Parker, who was president of Star King School for the Ministry when I was there. She is one of the most renowned theologians of this century and of the end of the 20th century. Her work has been all about liberation. She is a radical, revolutionary thinker. However, you have to wonder if she is, you know, really revolutionary, because these aren't new ideas at all. Here's a quote of hers. Parker, or from a book, notes that the construction of identity as a white person is to become more ignorant rather than seeing and understanding the world we actually live in. Our construction as white people, I agree with this, is to become more ignorant rather than seeing and understanding the world we actually live in. And then she goes on to say that knowledge allows us to disrupt injustice. To know is to love. You see why I willingly write out that check for student loans every month. Here's another idea that I find intriguing. The connection between skepticism and action. Now, I want to explore this in some Sunday later on. I hadn't ever thought about this. And the action would be to try to bend the arc of the universe a little more towards justice and mercy. I've never quite understood how the humanists, especially the free thinkers, could just keep going out there again and again and again. Remember when the humanist movement was at the beginning of the 1900s, and then what happened? Boom! World War I. And then what happened? The Great Depression. And then what happened? World War II. I mean, how do you keep going out there and out there and out there? So I've just recently read some things by Unitarian Universalist theologians about how skepticism is involved in that. You have to be skeptical, which, of course, we are, right? We free thinkers. You have to be skeptical about what they are telling us. We're not getting into conspiracies today, but how do we continue? How do we work for liberation? And doesn't liberation lie at the heart of liberal religion? As current liberal theologian Paul Raiser suggests, aren't we as free thinkers religious liberals after liberation? The word liberal comes from the Latin word liber, which means free. Then it follows that liberals believe there is a fundamental faith commitment to liberate themselves and by implication others who are denied some form of freedom. And again, isn't that what last Sunday's service was all about? Creating a safe environment for transgendered folks, for people who are not free, people who are marginalized in this country and whose identity is given to them by somebody else. That's crazy. So you should be proud of yourselves for a lot of things, but for last Sunday's service too. And now what are we doing? What are we doing in this country? We are officially wanting to keep, I don't, Syrian Refugees Act. Connect the dots. There isn't just one person who thinks that we should be letting as many Syrian refugees as possible into this country. It's not just me, there are lots of us out there. Many of us view this current anti-refugee movement and hysteria as similar to our failure in this country to let in Jewish refugees in the late 1930s. And then maybe in another 40 or 50 years, history will say that. In 1939, the St. Louis, that ship, set sail from Hamburg, Germany, with more than 900 Jewish refugees on board. Some of the refugees were admitted into Cuba, and the ship docked there, but over 800 of them were denied entry. The St. Louis was prohibited from docking in Florida and in Canada, and those refugees went where? Back to Europe, where nearly half of them died in concentration camps. We're doing it again. And I'm not equating the Holocaust. I mean, you can't equate the Holocaust, capital H, with anything else. But there are similarities here. We come from a long line of dead people. Oh, here's some other people in my cloud of witnesses. All those people who supported the sanctuary movement in the 1980s when Archbishop Weakland in Milwaukee made that the first Catholic archdiocese in the nation to do so.
And that included Prairie. Prairie was a sanctuary.
And Prairie was also a sanctuary. Thank you. I'm sure that Ruth's getting that, and the rest of you already know that and putting it in our history. So not everyone in my cloud is a Unitarian. Weakland's up there. But that set our state, this state of Wisconsin, apart from the rest of the United States as a haven for those seeking political and spiritual protection. What has happened? And in the comments, no bashing. I'm getting close to bashing someone here. But in the discussion, politics out of it, okay? This is our lineage. This is our heritage. As Unitarian Universalists, we should be very, very proud of this, but we should also be very, very humble about this. It is daunting to think of what some of those spiritual ancestors of ours have done, and it can be overwhelming to think about living up to their standards. I have no doubt that we're capable of doing so. We have no choice. That great cloud of witnesses pushing us forward, imploring us to be skeptics and liberators. The closing words are words from Adrian Rich. My heart is moved by all I cannot save. So much has been destroyed. I have to cast my lot with those who, age after age, perversely, with no extraordinary power, reconstitute the world. Go in peace, but don't go too far.